September 27th, 2017 seemed like a fairly typical morning for Jennifer Fulford. The 56-year-old was working as a nanny and house manager for a father and his two children in Winter Park, Florida. She arrived at the Berman family home around 7 a.m. to get the 10-year-old son ready for school. She dropped him off at 7:50 a.m. and then came back to the house. Little did she know, someone was watching her that morning. Jennifer saw the father, Reed Berman, off to work at 8:30 and then left to her dentist appointment. On her way back, she called Janet Grimm to tell her to head on over to the Berman's home for a previously arranged job, hanging a painting. Alarm records show the front door to the Berman house opened at 11:30 a.m. Minutes later, Jennifer called Janet to tell her not to come over after all, because there was an emergency at the boys' school and she had to pick him up. At 2:30 p.m. for regular school dismissal, the boy still hadn't been picked up. Reed Berman called Jennifer, but she didn't answer her phone and wasn't back at the house when he got there.
Was it out of the ordinary for Jennifer to not pick up your kids when she was scheduled to do so?
Yes.
Had that ever happened before?
Never.
In almost 7 years that she had been taking care of your kids?
Never happened.
Oddly enough, he found her purse in the downstairs bathroom. It appeared as though some chores had been done, but not all. He called her husband, checked with local hospitals, but still, no Jennifer. Finally, that night, Jennifer was reported as a missing person to the Winter Park Police Department. They noticed that $300 had been withdrawn from her bank account, and another $100 was taken out the next day at an ATM in Jacksonville, Florida, about 2.5 hours away. Police used her cell phone to track her movements and found her car abandoned in a grocery store parking lot. In it, they found a comforter for a bed and a bag containing a bloody watch. By the third day of her being missing, they discovered that she had been to a vacant lot near Disney World. Orange County Sheriff's helicopter pilots flew above it and made a gruesome discovery. They alerted deputies on the ground, who then found Jennifer's body. She was face down in the field with grass all around her. Her ankles were bound together with duct tape. Her wrists were bound together behind her with a zip tie. Duct tape was wrapped around her entire face, covering from her chin to her eyebrows. It appeared as though she had been dead for some time. Who killed Jennifer Fulford? And why did they do this? Police and a jury were about to hear for themselves. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 109. A strange man was seen at the two ATMs withdrawing money from Jennifer's account. He somehow knew her PIN. Police published his photo and got a tip with the name of a possible suspect, Scott Edward Nelson. A $20,000 reward was offered for information leading to his arrest. Reed Berman had never seen him. Jennifer's husband, Robert Fulford, didn't know him. What they did know was that he was a dangerous criminal. He had been paroled just months earlier from a federal prison for a bank robbery conviction. But they wouldn't have to wait long for him to turn up. The next day, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office found themselves in a confrontation with Nelson at a motel. Nelson said he was armed and warned them not to come into his room. Detective Kenneth Bowen spoke to Nelson over the phone and agreed to give him 10 minutes to smoke a cigarette before surrendering.
When I talked to him again after 10 minutes, he started stalling for more time, again, asking the reason that we were there. So I told him that, you know, I was a man of my word. And I was hoping he was going to be a man of his word and that we made a deal. It's time for him to live up to that deal. So he needed to come out and surrender now.
Nelson came out of his room and surrendered without incident. He said he was bluffing and never had a gun. He was taken to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and extradited to Orange County, where a judge ordered him to be held without bail. Nelson grew anxious as he sat behind bars. He saw an opportunity and wrote to Orlando Police Detective Brian Ferreira, offering to confess in exchange for, quote, better treatment in custody, including a single cell with a bottom bunk and more food or a food server job. Detective Ferreira and Detective Sharon Wagner sat down with Nelson in jail on November 13th, 2017. Nelson tells them that he's suffering horribly in jail because he's been accused of crimes. He explains that he had been living on the streets for months, lost his job, and needed cash. He said he went into Walmart and bought zip ties, duct tape, and a knife. He thought someone he used to work with knew the Berman house, and the Winter Park area had money, so he decided he was going to, quote, do a home invasion. The night before, he saw Jennifer going into the house around 5 p.m. with the boy. He knew this would be his target and came back the next morning. He saw UPS deliver a package at the front door.
The minute he drove away, I went out and I rang the doorbell and Jennifer answered. And I said to her, I said, you know, you have a package on the doorstep here. And she says, yeah, I know. And she was looking at me a little odd, like, yeah, I'm like, who are you? Why are you telling me this? And that's when I pushed the door and pushed it in. I went and shut the door and she screamed.
Okay.
And she was, you know, frightened.
Sure.
And I had a knife.
Okay.
So I told her to lay down on the floor, and then I bound her with some zip ties.
Okay.
And she was, I said, I'm not going to rape you, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm just here for the money.
Okay.
And she was not very helpful with my needs. Okay. She wouldn't give me any direction as to, you know, what was in the house, if there was anything in the house.
According to Nelson, he shoved the door open, pulled out a knife, and bound Jennifer with zip ties while she laid on the floor. She said she wouldn't tell him where the cash was in the house. He then checked to make sure that the alarm system wasn't activated. Jennifer said she had to pick up her grandson from school at 2:30 p.m. Her phone started ringing then, so Nelson shut it off. He then asked her for her ATM card and PIN number. He went upstairs and got a comforter off of a bed. He then wrapped her up in it, carried her out through the front door, and loaded her into the back of her own vehicle. Jennifer repeatedly told him she was having a hard time breathing because the comforter was blocking her mouth. Nelson drove to a nearby ATM and withdrew $300 from Jennifer's account. She offered him her wedding ring if he let her go free. He decided he couldn't just leave her on the side of the road, so he looked for an empty spot. He found one and realized he was likely near Disney World since he saw signs for Disney. As Nelson started to get Jennifer out of the vehicle, she began to scream louder, begging for her life. He forced her through a grassy field filled with thorn bushes. Jennifer continued to beg for her life, so he duct taped her mouth.
I had no intentions of killing her.
Okay.
But one thing led to another, and, so I killed her.
Exactly.
I stabbed her three times that I remember.
Do you remember where?
Yeah, once in the back, another time in the back, and then the third time, I was walking away, and I thought to myself, you know what? I'm not going to let this bitch testify against me because they're going to give me the same amount of time. So I killed her. I put one through her heart.
Nelson said that after he stabbed her for the first time, he went to put more duct tape on her face. That's when he said he decided he was going to kill her, so he duct taped her entire head. He stabbed her again in the back and thought it went through her lung. He turned her around and was going to leave, but then thought Jennifer would testify against him if she lived. So he stabbed her for a third time into her heart.
So I turned the knife and she was still alive. And even though it's stopped right in the middle of her chest, I knew that if I, and I did, and I just moved it, and she let out a gasp, and that was it, and she died.
He said he punched her in the head before duct taping her. He then threw the knife into the field. He said he intended to go back to the house and to hold the owner of the house until he could take him to the bank. But he was so cut up from the briars in the field that he had to clean himself up. His shirt and towel had blood all over them. He threw them out in a grocery store men's room. He left Jennifer's car in the parking lot and went into a 7-Eleven to buy a slice of pizza, what he referred to as a blood pizza.
And so I'm carrying my pizza. Little did these bastards know what I had to do for this friggin' pizza. Yeah. And I walked back up to that gazebo and I ate that pizza, every bite of it, and I enjoyed every damn bite of it. And I really did. And I hope, my only regret is that I hadn't killed 30 more sons of bitches like her.
Around 3:45 p.m., Nelson said he got on a city bus heading downtown. At 4:30, he tried getting more money from Jennifer's account, but was denied. He then went to an Amtrak station and bought a ticket for Jacksonville. Nelson wrote Detective Ferrara another letter later that year, but the detective didn't meet with him again. He was, however, able to recover Jennifer's car keys from the exact spot Nelson had said they would be, in a bush next to the bus stop across from the grocery store. In December 2017, Nelson was indicted on 5 charges: first-degree murder with a weapon, burglary of a dwelling with an assault or a batter, kidnapping with intent to inflict bodily harm or to terrorize, carjacking with a deadly weapon, and robbery with a deadly weapon. The Assistant State's Attorney's Office announced their intent to seek the death penalty. In May of 2018, Nelson wrote a letter to his judge saying that he would provide more details about his crimes if he got better food in jail. He said he suffers from mental illness and is starving. In the letter, Nelson told the judge, quote, "I have provided a full confession, gave up unsolved armed bank robberies, and promised to divulge 8 homicides. I have never been caught for this," Nelson said in the letter. In April 2019, Judge Keith White ruled Nelson competent to stand trial. And in June 2019, Nelson did just that. Her name was Jennifer Fulford. Assistant State's Attorney Kelly Hicks told a jury, "Jennifer was married and was working for Reed Berman." Hicks said Scott Nelson premeditatedly bought a knife to kill and took 6 things from the Berman house that day. The comforter from Berman's bed, located in the back of Jennifer's car. A bottle of beer from the fridge, found in the center console of Jennifer's car, with Nelson's DNA. Jennifer's car keys, found where Nelson said they would be. Jennifer's cell phone, never located, but used to locate her. Jennifer's ATM card, used multiple times by the defendant after she went missing. And finally, Jennifer herself, found in the field, bound with duct tape and zip ties that he bought and stabbed with the knife that he also purchased. Public defender Robert Lahr gave opening statements on behalf of the defense and told the jury to listen closely to cross-examination when making their ultimate determination. He reminded them of the United States Bill of Rights.
What's interesting is while this document is old and faded, that the principles that were espoused in that document stand strong today, particularly the one, the right to be tried by a fair and impartial jury.
Lahr said the only way to a fair and just verdict is to presume every person innocent until and unless the state proves the crime beyond all reasonable doubt. For Reed Berman, he said he was so concerned when he was unable to reach Jennifer on September 27th, 2017, that he started calling local hospitals in case she had been in a car accident. She never in all the years she had worked for him missed picking his son up from school. Berman agreed to let the Winter Park police search his home and electronic devices. He also sat down for an interview with them. He only realized a few days later that his duvet from his bed was missing. Besides that, nothing of value was missing from his home.
Do you know the defendant?
No.
Prior to September 27th of 2017, had you ever seen him before in your life?
No.
On cross-examination, the defense asked about his home security system.
I had cameras not in the house. They were outside of the house.
Outside of the house. Okay. And those were not working at that time, were they?
No.
Now, you also had a security system in the house?
Yes.
And it doesn't tell you who came in and came out. It just tells you that the door is open?
Correct.
Jennifer's husband, Robert Fulford, said they had been married for 7 years. When police knocked on his door to say that his wife might be missing, he checked Jennifer's bank account and saw a withdrawal for $300, the maximum allowed. Police then contacted Janet Grimm, whom Jennifer had scheduled to hang a painting in the Berman's house. Grimm said she played phone tag with Jennifer, trying to confirm when she would come over to the house. Eventually, Jennifer called her back.
She was very, very upset. She had a very panic in her voice. She told us not to come. The word I can panic.
Okay. Now, please tell us what it is she said to you.
She said that Oliver was sick and that she had to go to the school and pick him up.
Okay. Did she say anything else?
She told me not to come.
But a school employee told police the son was not sick. They were confused as to why Jennifer didn't pick the boy up and placed him in aftercare until his father could come get him. The Berman home alarm system records show the front door was opened at 11:47 a.m. A motion detector in the upstairs master bedroom was activated at 11:53. 3 minutes later, it was idle. At 11:54 a.m., someone was walking down the stairs in the home. Then, 16 minutes later, the suspect is seen on the ATM camera withdrawing money from Jennifer's account. Investigators tracked Jennifer's movements using her cell phone tower data information. Search crews, including a sheriff's office helicopter, followed that path. At 1:25 p.m., Jennifer's cell phone pinged 20 miles southwest of the home. First, they found her vehicle in a grocery store parking lot. In it, they found a white t-shirt, white towel, and a watch with a plaid band. They appeared to match the items Nelson was seen wearing when he withdrew cash from the ATM. They each had blood on them that later matched to Jennifer's and Nelson's DNA. Also in the back was the king-sized bedspread that came from Berman's bedroom. And a beer bottle was found in the center console that matched to one missing from the Berman's fridge. Detectives also discovered that Jennifer's phone pinged at 1:34 p.m. at a vacant lot, separated from the road by a thicket of brush. Investigators circled in on an empty lot with tall grass and vines with thorns. A dirt road then led them to Jennifer's body, with her arms behind her back, wrists bound with a zip tie, ankles taped together with duct tape, and duct tape wrapped around her entire head. Crime scene investigators found a white zip tie on the ground about 20 feet away from Jennifer. They searched the tree line, the dirt road, and the fields. They were losing daylight and hadn't found any weapons. Her body was taken to the medical examiner's office for forensic pathologist Dr. Joshua Stephanie to conduct an autopsy. He found that she suffered 7 stab wounds, 4 in the chest, 1 in the abdomen, and 2 in the back.
3 of the stab wounds in the chest, 1 hit the heart itself, 1 hit the pulmonary artery, which is a major artery that goes to your lungs, supplies the blood to your lungs, and 1 hits the left upper lung lobe. And then the stab wound in the abdomen, the lowest one, strikes the liver.
What would be the result of those wounds being inflicted on a person?
Well, the stab wound to the pulmonary artery, again, which is a major artery going to the lungs. If you're stabbed in that, you can bleed out. The stab wound going to the heart, again, you will bleed out. The stab wound going to the left upper lung lobe, you will bleed from that as left upper lung lobe. You will bleed out as well as causing a pneumothorax, meaning your lung may collapse. The stab wound going to the liver, again, you will bleed from.
Dr. Stephanie listed Jennifer's manner of death as homicide. He ruled her cause of death as stab wounds and asphyxia. Dr. Stephanie said Jennifer was likely both spurting blood outside her body and bleeding internally because of the wounds. But because of the condition she was found in, he was unable to tell definitively. He did determine that she was stabbed prior to her death. He also said the duct tape was wrapped around her head so tight that it pressed her ears and nose into her face. It completely blocked her nose and mouth, preventing her from breathing. Based on this, he said she could have suffocated in a matter of minutes. On cross, Nelson's defense asked about why he listed two possible causes of death.
You stated that the cause of death was asphyxiation and stab wounds?
Correct.
And you can't say that asphyxiation was her actual cause of death?
I can't say that there's findings you see on autopsy alone for asphyxia.
Okay, and so you're basing that opinion just on the fact that her nose and mouth were covered by the duct tape?
Correct.
And you can't say whether that duct tape was placed there before or after her death?
Based on the autopsy alone, no.
Dr. Stephanie said the stab wounds to her chest could have caused death on their own. The defense wanted to know about the direction in which she was stabbed because their client had previously told police that he had twisted the knife.
None of the stab wounds that you looked at showed any twisting or turning. Is that correct?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay, so they would have been straight in and out?
Yes.
And you cannot say whether Ms. Fulford was standing, sitting, laying down when these injuries occurred?
That's correct.
Dr. Stephanie said he was unable to estimate her exact time of death. He said she could have died instantly in a couple of minutes or longer than a couple of minutes. He was unable to tell. When it was the defense's turn to present their case, their client let it be known that they would only be calling one witness, Scott Edward Nelson. Before the jury was brought in, Judge White made sure that he understood he had a right to not testify and that the jury could not hold it against him. In choosing to testify, the jury now could consider his testimony for the weight of its credibility. And one other thing to clarify before he took the stand. The state said they were aware of three prior felony convictions for Nelson. He told the judge that was incorrect. He said he actually had three separate, one state and two federal, with a total of six felony convictions.
Your Honor, I assure you, 100% is six. There's no ambiguity. It's six.
Okay.
It's truthful, honest, legit. Yeah, I have six.
All right.
I mean, I could name them right off the top of my head.
You don't need to do that, sir.
Judge White asked Nelson if he understands that he has the right to get advice from his attorneys, but he himself has the final decision if he'll take the stand. Nelson said his attorneys advised him not to speak, but that he really wants to. He insisted that a simple sentence needs to be said.
We've already crossed that bridge, and if, you know, they don't want me to, but I really want to, Your Honor. It's important to me. It's a simple sentence. It needs to be said.
And so Scott Nelson took the stand in front of a jury of his peers. He told them he's 55 years old. Then he was asked to explain who Julio Dominguez is.
Julio Dominguez is employed by the U.S. Department of Justice, United States Probation Office in Orlando, Florida.
And how is he related to this case?
Well, sir, he was my probation officer. I was on supervised release
Okay, and what is the importance of his involvement in this case?
Well, sir, I'll be very frank with you. Jennifer Lynn Fulford would be alive today had it not been for Julio Dominguez.
And the reason for that statement, sir?
I think the world should know that. I mean, it's justice. The truth should be known, sir.
And with that, Nelson's direct examination was concluded. The state proceeded to cross-examine him. Nelson said he was born in Massachusetts and raised in New Hampshire. He moved to Orlando in May of 2017 under the supervision of Julio Dominguez, his federal probation officer.
Did Mr. Dominguez kill Jennifer Fulford?
No.
Who killed Jennifer Fulford?
I did.
Nelson accused Dominguez of telling his employer the reason he was on probation at the end of August 2017. He said the painting company fired him because of that and kicked him out of the room where they allowed him to stay. He said he got one $500 paycheck, which he used to open a bank account. He then used a check from that account to make those purchases at Walmart. Nelson said he bought those materials as a plan to survive life on the streets for the third or fourth time.
You know, once you kick a dog enough times, they tend to bite back. And really, they just don't care anymore.
Tell us about your plan.
My plan was to get some money and abscond.
He said the owner of the painting company introduced him to someone who had a, quote, beef with Reed Berman, but he couldn't remember the name of that person, and they're unconnected to Julio Dominguez. But that all somehow led him to target Jennifer Fulford.
I believe the term is collateral damage.
All right. You're saying that Jennifer Fulford was collateral damage as a result of your disliking Mr. Dominguez and how he treated you.
Well, I believe it's yes, but it's more accurate that he had a problem with me rather than I having a problem with him.
Nelson refused to answer the prosecutor's questions with just a yes or no answer, saying in doing so would be like putting a gag in his mouth. He said he never filed a complaint about Dominguez, but did consider shooting him. He formed a new plan when he turned his attention to the people of Winter Park.
So, in September, when you went to the Walmart and acquired the knife and the duct tape and the zip ties, remember the zip ties?
Yeah. Never leave home without them.
Thank you for that quote.
Levity.
Nelson said he planned on doing a home invasion to get as much money as possible. If someone was hurt in that home invasion, it would be collateral damage. The prosecutor began to press Nelson on the timeline of when he decided Jennifer would be his target. He said a lot of what he told detectives in his interview was false.
A lot of what I told the detectives was untrue because we started off with a quid pro quo and they started weaseling out and playing their games and it started giving me a little enjoyment watching them squirm. Because some of the answers I gave them, the blood pizza, come on. That's a lot of inaccurate information I gave them because they weren't being forthcoming with my needs. They weren't trying to help me. They just wanted to squeeze me. So I just gave them a lot of BS back.
The prosecutor asked if Nelson's statement in court and what he said to detectives was all a sham. He said no and denied asking for a bottom bunk and food in exchange for giving them information.
I told him straight up, quid pro quo. You help me, I'll help you. That's it.
All right. Well,
how detectives are. They squeeze you. Then they ba-boom. You get nothing in the end.
Sure.
I mean, it's what you guys do. You're very good at it.
Does that mean that what you told him about killing Jennifer Fulford was untrue?
No, that is true.
All right. So let's go back to how that occurred.
Julio Dominguez.
We're past that. Let's get back to September 26th of 2017. You're on foot, correct?
Yeah.
You have your duct tape and zip ties and knife with you.
What does this have to do with Julio Dominguez? I mean, if you want to sit here and talk to me and grill me for the next 3 hours, I'm not doing this. I came up here for one reason. Julio Dominguez is the reason Jennifer Lynn Fulford died. That's it. That's all I have to say.
All right.
If you wanted anything more, talk to my lawyers. That's it.
Your Honor, would the court direct Mr. Nelson to answer the questions of all attorneys, not just his lawyer?
Well, need that.
My memory's getting real foggy right now. Nelson, I'm sorry. I must need my medication.
Nelson, don't speak when I'm speaking. Do you understand, sir? You understand, sir?
Yes.
When asked what happened that day, Nelson repeatedly answered, "I don't recall," and said he has had head injuries. Prosecutor, were you hanging around the house waiting for Jennifer Fulford to appear? Nelson, I don't recall. You don't see the driver pull in with the package? I don't recall. Did you force your way into the house? I don't recall any of this stuff right now, ma'am. Did you take money out of Jennifer's bank account by forcing her to give you her PIN number? I don't recall. Did you get $300 from Jennifer's bank account? I'm sorry, I can't help you. I just don't remember all of this. What does the confession say? Prosecutor, did you go into Reed Berman's bedroom and get the comforter off the bed so that you could put Jennifer in it so that you didn't have to drag her out of the house kicking and screaming? Nelson, Reed Berman slept in that bed a couple of nights and he didn't even know the comforter was missing. Maybe he took it. Prosecutor, did you go into Jennifer Fulford's car after placing her in the back and drive her to the ATM where you withdrew $300 at noon? Nelson, I'm sorry, I just don't know, ma'am.
I was looking for a place to dump her. Get rid of her.
Okay.
Next question.
And so as you were driving, you absolutely knew that you weren't just going to leave her in a remote area. You were going to kill her.
No. Now that you're wrong about.
So when you say get rid of her, you mean just drop her off?
Well, yeah, that's what the zip ties were for.
Just drop her off, somehow restrained.
Yes.
If she died, so be it. If she died before somebody found her, so be it.
That's a matter of opinion.
Was that your thinking?
No, that sounds like it's your thinking.
Nelson said he found the remote area and opened the back hatch to the vehicle. He couldn't remember how she got through the field, but he said he knew she did not have tape over her eyes then.
You've had a knife this whole time, right? That knife we saw? That green and black knife?
How are you supposed to carry someone and carry a knife at the same time? Or how are you supposed to, I mean...
Was it in your pocket?
I think I left it in the vehicle. And then I had to go back and get it, I guess.
He admitted to taking Jennifer's car and driving to the grocery store, to cleaning up and changing his clothes. He then walked across the street and threw her car keys in a bush. He said he remembers going to the train station and buying a ticket. He said he allowed the authorities to catch him. He wanted them to catch him.
So you committed the worst possible crime in order to either get to death row so you could have a single cell or back into prison so that you could get free medical care. Yes?
No. Absolutely not. You're wrong. Right. You're drumming something up.
So it was all about the money then? All about the money.
Isn't everything?
Is that a yes?
I had to eat. I'm a human being.
Is that a yes?
You're damn right it's yes.
Nelson's defense had no questions for redirect.
Well, on September 27th of 2017, this was about getting money. Not about his probation officer or trying to make a point to the people that he considers snobs in Ware Park. This was about getting as much cash as he could from one source.
In her closing arguments, the prosecutor quoted Nelson when he said that Jennifer Fulford's death was just collateral damage.
There is no doubt that Mr. Nelson
plotted, planned, premeditated, this home invasion robbery, and that when Mrs. Fulford did not comply with his requests, she became this collateral damage. As such, he is guilty of murder in the first degree, kidnapping, robbery, and carjacking.
Defense attorney Robert Lahr asked the jury to focus on the premeditation clause in the murder charge. He said Nelson said himself it was never his intent to kill her, that getting rid of just meant dumping her in an isolated place. Zip ties, duct tape, and a knife can be used for a lot of different purposes other than murder, he said. Nelson didn't have an escape plan and didn't have plans to dispose of a body. And he said Nelson only stabbed her after she was getting loud.
What's interesting is the way that Mr. Nelson described it to the detectives. It was bizarre because he said things that didn't seem to match up with what the medical examiner had. Because, and again, when you know he made these comments about trying to shock the detectives, kind of did. Because what did he say at one point? He took the knife and he twisted it. Well, when you heard the medical examiner talk about it, he said there was no twisting of the knife. When he talked about the fact that she was saying, no, 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 well, if you remember, he supposedly also said he had the tape over the mouth. So how could she have said no, no, no? Because he didn't have the breath to be able to do that, if that's what was happening. Again, if you're looking at that, that seemed to bear out the fact that what he was saying wasn't really the truth, that it was, and of course I know it sounds like, yeah, Mr. Lahr, you sound like you want to have it both ways, okay, and you can't, I would understand that, but you got to look at what seems to fit with what is there.
Lahr said there was no evidence that Nelson hit her in the back of the head, as he told the detectives he did. He said instead, Nelson panicked and killed her, which would go to disprove premeditation. According to Lahr, Nelson didn't intend on depriving Jennifer of her vehicle. He only wanted to use it to go to the ATM. He instructed the jury to look at the lesser included of the carjacking charge and rather find him guilty of grand theft of a motor vehicle. As for the kidnapping charge, Lahr said he did not intend to inflict bodily harm or to terrorize her. It may have been the result, however. He instructed the jury to look at the lesser included charge of false imprisonment. He then asked them to find Nelson guilty of petty theft instead of robbery because he only withdrew $300 from her account.
And it's a tragedy, Miss Fulford had passed away, that he was killed. It was never the intent. Never the intent that Mr. Nelson put into play. Now, as David got up here and said, we have proven this case beyond a reasonable doubt. Candidly, the best I think they have, and it's going to be an instruction that you're going to read, be able to read, is second-degree murder. Take a look at that.
Lahr concluded by asking the jury to look at the charge of second-degree murder rather than first-degree murder. The final word, however, went to the state in their rebuttal arguments. Prosecutor Kelly Hicks said maybe Nelson did just want money. The problem is that there's no set time for premeditation. It's killing someone after consciously deciding to do so. The law does not fix the exact period of time that must pass between the formation of the premeditation intent to kill and the killing. It is entirely irrelevant, she said, if he intended to kill her when he bought the supplies, knocked on the front door, put her in the back of the car, or drove her to the vacant lot.
But when you wrap the duct tape around her head over and over again, you are intending to kill her. When you take a knife and you stab somebody, not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, not five times, not six times, seven times. You want that person dead. That is premeditation.
Hicks said the state also proved felony murder by showing that Jennifer was killed while Nelson committed kidnapping, robbery, and carjacking. He robbed her while he held her against her will, took her ATM card, and got money from her account. He carjacked her by stealing her keys, and he kidnapped her, starting from when he knocked on the door until when he put a knife through her heart.
We have proven to you the beginning of the story. We have proven to you the middle of the story. Ladies and gentlemen, the story ends today. The story ends when you go back into that deliberation room and you find the defendant guilty of kidnapping, carjacking, robbery, and the first degree murder of Jennifer Fulford. Jennifer's story ends with him being found guilty.
After 4 hours of deliberations, the jury reached their verdict: guilty of all charges. The jury now had another decision to make. Would Nelson get the death penalty or be sentenced to life in prison? Prosecutors argued that Nelson's crime was especially heinous because of his prior criminal record. He had been out on probation at the time he murdered Jennifer. Nelson pleaded guilty to robbing a bank in Daytona Beach, Florida in 2011. He had sat down to open an account, then calmly warned an employee that he had a briefcase bomb that would, quote, light everything in this bank on fire. Another employee heard what was going on and called 911. Nelson was arrested in the parking lot. The bomb he had left inside the bank was actually two empty propane canisters. Nelson had been released from a federal prison in Vermont just 11 days before that. In 1994, Nelson kidnapped his father at gunpoint. He took his father to a bank and forced him to withdraw $10,000 by threatening to shoot employees and customers if he alerted anyone. Nelson was arrested after a manhunt and sentenced to 15 years in prison. After this conviction, he ran a newspaper advertisement apologizing for his heinous act and called it a family matter that obviously went out of control. Nelson was also convicted in 1984 for assault and in 1989 for robbery. The defense told the court that Nelson's behaviors were a result of having an absent father, a schizophrenic mother, and spending 25 years in federal prison, most of which was in solitary confinement. Nelson's brother described a childhood filled with abuse by their father and said their mother was placed in a mental institution. The defense said Nelson was physically abused and raped by his cellmate. They said he suffered PTSD because of it and spent 19 years in solitary confinement due to minor prison violations. He had been diagnosed with severe mental illness and has cognitive impairments from brain damage. They admitted he is responsible for the crime, but said his individual circumstances affect his ability to make rational decisions. A neuropsychologist, neurologist, psychologist, and prison expert all testified for the defense. But Nelson insisted on taking the stand again, and he again blamed his probation officer for ruining his life.
How has your mental health been affected by your previous incarceration?
I am a homicidal maniac.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to be sentenced to death?
Yes.
I'm going to object. That's an improper question.
I'll sustain the objection.
Prosecutors painted a picture of who Jennifer Fulford was as a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. Her husband, Robert, said she planned on flying to Texas the next day to see the birth of one of her grandchildren.
Jennifer Fulford was my wife, my best friend, and quite honestly, amazing. She was the mother of two children, and also a proud grandmother. According to Jenny, she was going to be on her front porch in a rocking chair with a glass of wine, watching her great children play in the yard when she passed away. She was supposed to be 95 years old. Today, we all know how Jenny died. But I'd like to share a little bit about how she lived. Jenny was amazingly intuitive. She could not hide her feelings, and it was impossible to hide feelings from her. She almost had a sixth sense that she liked to call the Hungarian voodoo. She had a special talent for bringing out the best in others. She had a way of knowing that a smile would improve an angry passerby's day. She would often start up conversations with a stranger that would begin to sound like they were old friends. There are too many things to list, so I will end with the most important. Jenny was loving. A list of things that Jenny loved could go on for hours. First and foremost, she loved her family. She loved people. She loved the holidays. And she loved animals. She loved life. She loved me. I will always love her.
The jury deliberated for 16 hours over 2 days and then decided to recommend life in prison, sparing Nelson the death penalty. There's no parole in the state of Florida, so under these circumstances, he will never be released again. As for the other crimes Nelson claimed he was responsible for, including 8 homicides, as he said in his jail letter to detectives, nothing has yet been made public as to whether there's any truth to that. One report just said that according to police sources, they were currently looking into at least 1 other crime out of state. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. What did you make of Scott Nelson's testimony? Do you agree with the sentencing, or do you think he should have been sentenced to death? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Jennifer Tintner from the Law and Crime Trial Network. You can follow Jennifer on Twitter @JenniferTintner. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.